comments until then. So take it away, Tom.
Thank you, Priya. Okay, so last Sunday's rally of close to 2 million in Hong Kong is just a reminder of the immense resilience and depth of this fight for democracy, which has now been going for 12 weeks. The revolt in Hong Kong is the biggest popular uprising for democracy in Asia for many decades. The first thing to say is that socialists absolutely support the protests as a basic struggle for democracy and against the further encroachment of authoritarian rule in Hong Kong. The protest movement started soon after the extradition bill was first announced in February, building up to monster demonstrations of 1 million, followed the next weekend by 2 million people, one quarter of the entire Hong Kong population, out on the streets. This forced Carrie Lam, the chief executive, very quickly to suspend the application of the extradition bill, but not to withdraw it. And that then became the main driving demand of the protests, which have only grown and been sustained ever since then. So if you've been following the news, I'm sure many people have. I'm not going to go into much great detail about the protests, but you'll know that people have been coming out repeatedly in their tens, if not the hundreds of thousands, in mass demonstrations, in blockading the airport, forcing it shut down on a couple of occasions, a huge general strike on the 9th of August of 350,000, the biggest general strike in the territory since 1967. And we've seen demonstrations inside the metro stations, playing cat and mouse with the cops, and a whole series of inventive forms of public protest. Just yesterday, the arms linked across the island, what was it, 5 kilometres, 10, 20 kilometre human chain, candlelit taking place across the whole island. Just before I go on, just by forms of terminology, I understand that 80% of the land mass of Hong Kong is actually on the mainland, but just for the sake of simplicity, I'm going to call it the island, okay? But I do know about the new territories. Okay, and I'm going to call, you know, the Beijing government essentially the mainland government. So just by way of a quick geographical clarification there. Okay, so these protests, of course, have kept the authorities in Hong Kong wrong-footed for week after week. The government has tried to pacify the protests by an announcement of various budget measures to put more money in people's pockets, but they refuse to move on the key question of withdrawing entirely the extradition bill. In fact, the authorities have responded increasingly brutally. I remember the Umbrella Revolution, I think it was my birthday, 27th of September 2014, the authorities used tear gas. And this was a huge shock to people of Hong Kong, that people, the tear gas were used to disperse protesters. Now tear gas is just kind of like, yeah, whatever. I mean, thousands of tear gas canisters have been hurled at protesters. Not just that, rubber bullets, batons, tear gas used in confined spaces like MTR stations, tear gas basically flung into deserted residential streets, just like a fuck you kind of display of power, and the repression has only escalated. And partly this repression has actually only fueled rather than intimidated the protests. And also, rather than intimidating the broader population, has only won the protesters more sympathy. Demonstrated last Sunday's rally, where people marched for hours in driving monsoonal rain. It was also clear in the donations that have been left for the protesters at MTR stations, the changes of clothes, the subway tokens, the small vouchers, helmets, the medical assistance and everything else. The authorities have hardly been going out of their way to win the hearts and minds of the population of Hong Kong. I've already mentioned the tear gas flung down deserted neighbourhood streets, the battening of bystanders, most famously and infamously, the Yuen Long MTR station a few weeks ago. This is close to the border of the mainland, but obviously the government and the gangster stooges who did this thought they'd do this in an area of CCP strength near the border, but in fact the following weekend 200,000 people turned up in protest at the gangster brutality authorised and endorsed by the Hong Kong police. So you can say the protests still have the sympathy and in many cases active participation of hundreds of thousands, not millions of people on the island. The main character of the protests, as many people have observed, is they are supposedly leaderless. There's a formal structure known as the Civil Human Rights Front, which brings together political parties, trade unions, NGOs and so forth. And the authority of these organisations is important in terms of putting out, if you like, a territory-wide claim or demand or protest call. But nonetheless, the real leadership is on the streets amongst the young, angry and radicalising youth. The situation is different to the Umbrella Revolution. when many of the leaders had already emerged as figureheads. Now, the pan-democrats, Her Majesty's loyal opposition, or whatever, the CCP's loyal opposition in a legislative council, are essentially despised as spineless. The localists are much weaker today than they were in 2014 as a result of internal division and state repression. Demosistos, led by Joshua Wong, an international figure, which arose out of the scholarism movement of 2012, have not really come to the fore this time round. The protests in many cases are simply called by individuals on Facebook. The general strike that happened on the 9th of August actually arose as a result of sort of spontaneous demands from below, was not driven primarily and initially by the trade unions, but was taken up by them. Many times the protests were organised just through informal group chats on Telegram. So we have, you know, social media being used as a way of bringing people together who do not necessarily meet and plan and organise in the flesh. So it's the sheer willpower and desperation, a rage at the actions of the authorities and their intransigence that keeps the protests going. Now, the driving factors behind these protests are twofold, often commented on. I don't claim any great innovation here. First is the whole question of Hong Kong identity. We'll know about the one country, two systems model introduced after 1997. One of the major grievances is essentially is that basic law, which enshrined that independence of the legal and political system in Hong Kong, is being wound back by the mainland authorities. For example, the imposition of mainland police and immigration officials at Express Railway Station in Kowloon, the promotion of Mandarin and the sidelining of Cantonese, which is spoken by 90% plus of the Hong Kong population. These developments have provoked a string of protests over the years over a national security law, the attempt to introduce a national curriculum in the schools, the arrest of booksellers who disappear only to reappear in the mainland confessing to spurious charges, and the jailing and disbarring from political office of many of the leaders of the Umbrella Movement. More substantial, however, than any of his individual acts is the gradual cultivation of substantial political forces in Hong Kong favouring the Chinese Communist Party, the sponsoring of big umbrella organisations, bringing together hundreds of patriotic parties, professional groups, community associations, loyal to the CCP, lubricated by funds and business connections. All of these tendencies have created a much greater sense of identification with Hong Kong and lesser identification with China, particularly amongst the young people in Hong Kong who've only grown up in the context of the Beijing boot being firmly in their face. Now, this Hong Kong identity is not a straightforward thing. It is quite capable and has been channeled into a chauvinist, anti-Chinese, anti-mainlander direction. In recent years, there have been a string of mobilisations targeting mainland tourists and migrants, accused of driving up property prices, cleaning out supermarket shelves, taking over hospital beds. And the right-wing localists, who came to prominence in the years running up to the 2014 Umbrella Movement, made the running on these issues. But in the current situation, the identification with Hong Kong and Hong Kong identity, I would argue, is more akin to trying to hold on to a few liberal rights that do exist in the territory. The freedom to speak, to demonstrate, to assemble, a fair hearing in court, things that in China are absent. This then is a context for the huge rebellion, but it's fused with underlying discontent about social and economic conditions. Hong Kong is a capitalist paradise. Low regulation, low wages, huge accumulation of fortunes in the hand of a tiny favoured few, home to many of the richest people in Asia. But for the mass of Hong Kongers, life is very tough. Probably everyone has heard that Hong Kong has the most expensive real estate in the world. People are unable to move out of home because of the impossibility of finding a rental property themselves. Mothers and fathers with kids being forced to live in squalid and cramped conditions. Young people living in what are called coffin apartments, no more space to lie down and sleep. There is no meaningful state pension in Hong Kong, and the younger generation are finding it harder than ever to get by compared to the older. Is this what I would call a class difference that helps to explain why it's misguided to see the current revolt as simply one about being Hong Kongers against mainlanders? Even though the whole situation is refracted through the lens of nationalism and the demands are still on the terrain of liberal democracy, the factor driving the revolt and a resistance to it is class and class interests. Now, this is not exactly a conventional understanding of things. The media, for example, often describe the protesters as middle class. Something like 80% of them have tertiary qualifications or are studying for them. About half of them describe themselves as middle class. But in some ways, it's their educated status that makes the situation all the more galling. They did what they were told. They studied to get themselves into a position where they could get a decent job, leave home, rent a flat, start a family. And all they're stuck with is the three no's. No money, no jobs, no democracy. And the more educated ones can actually be the most angry and most alienated. Those involved in the roving demonstrations, more likely to end up with confrontations with the cops, are in fact more likely to have university degrees, but also more likely to describe themselves as lower class. What use is their degree when it leads them nowhere? So I'd argue then it's class grievances, the lack of democracy, the crap wages, the appalling housing situation, the lack of social security that explains why it is that hundreds of thousands, indeed millions, keep coming out into the streets time and again. Likewise, on the other side of the coin, it's the class interests of the rich and powerful, both in Hong Kong and the mainland, that explain why they're determined to resist the demands. In order to understand this, we need to understand something about the power structure in Hong Kong. The ruling force in Hong Kong, the dominant force in Hong Kong, is the Chinese Communist Party. The nominal head of Hong Kong is its chief executive, Carrie Lam. She, however, is appointed by Beijing on the advice of a tiny group of prominent and usually wealthy individuals on the island. Ever since she was forced to suspend the extradition bill, Carrie Lam has been a lame duck. But Beijing will not allow, and through their local office in Hong Kong, will not allow Lam to drop the bill, nor to quit, even though she's a laughingstock, for fear that if the protests are seen to succeed, this will open deepen demands for democratisation in Hong Kong and also encourage protests on the mainland. The authorities are not wrong to worry. Most mainlanders share the same grievances as those in Hong Kong. Rampant property speculation making housing unaffordable. Lack of secure jobs. Harsh and dangerous working conditions for Mandarin workers. And vast inequality between the well-connected super-rich and the mass of workers and students. The prospect that unrest in Hong Kong might spill over into the mainland is a nightmare that keeps the authorities in Hong Kong and in Beijing awake at night. Carrie Lam, of course, presides over the Legislative Council, which is really no more than the toy parliament, dominated by the pro-Beijing camp, using enormous resources at their disposal to buy support. The so-called Pan Dem camp, essentially middle-class liberals, comprises about one quarter of the floor of LegCo, but is pretty much mouthpieces for Western businesses and are fairly ineffectual. The Communist Party works hand in glove with Chinese Hong Kong capitalists, figures such as Li Ka-shing, the richest man in Asia, CEO of CK Hutchison, a vast holding company that's done very well since the handover in 1987, now valued at $33 billion on the stock exchange, with 200,000 employees and investments and interests not just in Hong Kong, not just the mainland, but in Latin America, Europe and elsewhere in Asia. Li's grip on the Hong Kong property market is completely dependent on the support of the Communist Party. And not just in Hong Kong. The Chinese Hong Kong capitalists also directly benefit from the exploitation of mainland workers, having shut down their factories in Hong Kong in the 1990s and 2000s and moved them to Shenzhen, which is the huge industrial city just north of the Hong Kong border. And essentially, that has deindustrialised Hong Kong, leaving the island very dependent on services, banking, tourism and so forth. The Chinese Hong Kong capitalists, therefore, as a result, are tied by a thousand strings to the Communist Party, which can destroy their businesses at the stroke of a pen, and, as has become a pattern under Xi Jinping, disappear them onto the mainland where they may never be heard from again. These capitalists share the same interests as the political leaders in cracking down the protest movement. They don't want to have to deal with a population that knows how to stand up for their rights, that might use this confidence to demand a better deal for themselves, higher wages, state pensions, public housing. More than that, they're pissed off with the impact of the protests in their own businesses, the drying up of hotel bookings, the property industry seizing up, the glut of unsold properties building up. That's why the Chinese Hong Kong capitalists are extremely cooperative with the CCP demands that they issue statements condemning the protests. They don't agree to do this because they're simply lackeys of Beijing. They do this because it's in their class interest to do this. They hate democracy as much as Beijing CCP does. But the trend isn't just one way of Hong Kong capitalists going to the mainland. The Chinese mainland capitalist class has also done very well out of the handover. Big mainland businesses now raise billions of dollars of international capital through Hong Kong stock markets. Half are listed companies on the Hong Kong Stock Exchange and our mainland businesses. And many thousands of high-up party members have a very personal interest in Hong Kong as well. They know that they're just, they know that they're at risk of the knock on the door and the instant arrest and disappearance of themselves or family members. They have therefore stashed family fortunes in Hong Kong, buying up property, buying up essentially an escape route for themselves to keep them out, to keep their wealth out of reach of Beijing financial regulators. It's in their interest, therefore, to see Hong Kong prosper. So you can see, then, the intertwining of the interests of the Hong Kong politicians, the Chinese Hong Kong business owners, and the mainland businesses all joined together through their connections to the Communist Party. In many cases, these people are members of the Communist Party. It's not the case in China you have, like, the political structures here and the business structures there. There is an incredible intertwining of the Communist Party with business in the mainland. You simply cannot get ahead building up a major business in China without the assistance of the Communist Party. Then there are the Western capitalists, who, of course, long been central to the Hong Kong economy. The big British trading houses like Swire Group, like Jardine Matheson, dominated the Hong Kong economy for more than 100 years. They've had to, if you like, share the stage with other capitalists in recent years, but they've still done very well out of integration with the Chinese mainland economy. Take the Swire Group, for example. It owns 1.7 million square metres of prime real estate in Hong Kong Island, including swanky hotels, shopping malls and all the rest of it. But it's not just in Hong Kong. They now own 1.2 million square metres of prime real estate in Beijing, in Guangzhou, Shanghai, Chengdu. And so you can see the way their property empires have now spread across quote-unquote countries. Also, the Swire Group has a big interest, people will probably know, in Cathay Pacific, which has been in the news a lot recently. So the Swire Group's ownership of Cathay Pacific is now intertwined with cross-share holdings with the Chinese state-owned Air China. And Cathay Pacific sees its future as being more tourist and business travels from the mainland. Again, you can see the interest of the Swire Group in working with the Chinese Communist Party. Swire also has a monopoly over the manufacturing bottle of Coca-Cola in Hong Kong, ditto the mainland. Again, you can see time and again the way in which Hong Kong big business, which prospered under British rule, is now prospering under Chinese rule and extending their business investments onto the mainland and its vast population of 1.3 billion. And not just the Swire Group, I've already mentioned Jardine Matheson, which made its fortune in the misery of the Chinese people through the opium trade, build up a huge and diversified business interest across Asia, including the mainland and Hong Kong. Like the Chinese Hong Kong capitalists, the Western capitalists are also hostile to the mass protests. They may have initially tried to distance themselves, try to avoid having to come down hard on one side or the other. They no doubt had fears the extradition laws could be applied to them, that in the event of a falling out with a Communist Party leader, in the event of a falling out with a well-connected Chinese business, they could find themselves arrested and extradited to the mainland as well. However, their joint interest in exploiting workers in Hong Kong and the mainland have overridden these qualms they initially had. The fact is the protests have driven down the Hong Kong Stock Exchange over the last 2 months, and this means that when the Chinese Communist Party instructs them to get off the fence and back Carrie Lam, as it has done the last 2 weeks, they do so without much hesitation. Finally, no account of the class structure in Hong Kong is complete without some reference to the triads, organised crime. Like in Italy and the mafia, property development in Hong Kong is intimately tied up with organised crime, which has long been active in the territory. The triads are both major business operations and provide a more legitimate capitalist with various avenues to launder money and hire thugs to intimidate their rivals and militant workers and radical students on the streets. The CCP has established working relations with the triads, dishing various favours their way through property deals in new apartment buildings. So drawing all these threads together then, we have the party state apparatus based in Beijing with its representatives in place in the ruling institutions for Hong Kong, very much mixed with and intertwined with the mainland capitalists who raise funds through Hong Kong Stock Exchange, do business on the island and stash their ill-gotten gains there out of reach of Beijing. There are the Hong Kong Chinese capitalists like Li Ka-shing, who are big players in real estate and trading and who have, in many cases, extensive investment operations in places like Shenzhen. There are the international capitalists, who are also big property investors and maintain regional offices in Hong Kong. And finally, the triads who cross all the economic and political boundaries. All of these categories of social layers have prospered since the 1990s. However, the relationship between them has not remained the same. In the 1990s, Hong Kong accounted for one quarter of Chinese total GDP. The figure today is just 3% as a result of a huge economic explosion in China in the last 30 years. Hong Kong therefore matters less to Beijing now than it did in the 1990s, while the mainland matters more to businesses based in Hong Kong. The Communist Party in Beijing therefore is in a stronger position to dictate terms to Hong Kong than it was in 1997. And this is in part what lies behind Beijing's tightening grip on Hong Kong politics. But regardless of the changing relationship between these different fractions of capital and control, the mainland and Hong Kong interests remain united in their desire for order in Hong Kong. In other words, the continued suppression of the democratic aspirations of people of Hong Kong and the mainland too, of course. That fact has the potential, very importantly, to create a sharper class polarisation in the movement today and to sideline the anti-mainlander sentiment. Finally, what are the working class in Hong Kong? In the first decades of the 20th century, the Hong Kong working class was one of the most militant and left-wing in the world. It was at the centre of the national liberation struggle in China. It was crushed, however, by the British authorities in the late 1920s and kept down for subsequent decades. In 1967, anger at colonial repression drove workers into a general strike, but the struggle against British rule was called off on the orders of the Peking Communist Party. Today, there are two union federations in Hong Kong. One essentially is a yellow union run by the Chinese Communist Party, the Hong Kong Federation of Trade Unions, which has 400,000 members. That essentially, to all intents and purposes, is a scab union. Because when the other union federation, the Hong Kong Confederation of Trade Unions, with about 200,000 members, goes on strike, as they have done on the waterfront, in the schools, amongst teachers, and I think the Cathay Pacific unions might belong to Hong Kong Confederation as well, the Hong Kong Federation of Trade Unions, the Communist Party Federation, actually scabs on them. So that obviously weakens the power of the trade unions. And it's also a fair challenge to organise in Hong Kong because so much industry has moved to the mainland now. So many of the factories have gone to Shenzhen. So much of manufacturing, which used to dominate the island, has now gone north. And, exacerbating the situation, the left in Hong Kong is very weak. But nonetheless, as is evident from the popular explosion in the past 3 months, even without mass organisations, workers have still been prepared to join in the demonstrations, as you can tell, for example, from the arrest lists that are produced by the Hong Kong police. Now, let's bring it back to the situation on the streets today. The big question now is, what is Beijing prepared to do? Thus far, the Communist Party is hoping the activists will just end up worn out, demoralised or in jail. But they could offer military intervention, using the PLA garrison in Hong Kong and possibly sending over the armed police amassing just over the border. The Chinese leadership has been ramping up its rhetoric in recent weeks, calling the protesters terrorists, calling the demonstrations riots. So we can by no means rule out bloody repression on the streets of Hong Kong. Now, this is not guaranteed to happen, of course. The Chinese ruling class may have concerns it would lead to, amongst other things, American retaliation. It might make the territory ungovernable. They may be concerned that to do so would put back the whole idea of peaceful unification with Taiwan back decades. But given the experience of Tiananmen Square, we should have no illusions this is a step they would not take when push comes to shove. And as socialists and as progressive in Australia, obviously we should be ready in that situation to protest such a move extremely vigorously. What about the movement itself? Where now? Well, obviously a very important thing is the need to maintain mass involvement in the protests. Now, in some ways it sounds funny coming from Australia where we're lucky to get 5,000 to demonstration. These people are getting hundreds of thousands, not millions, coming along regularly. But that mass component is precisely what's made the thing so powerful. In fact, we've seen an interaction, actually. In some ways it's one weekend, one thing, what happens the next weekend is something else. One weekend is a mass protest, a peaceful marches through the streets. The other weekend you'll see maybe tens of thousands are coming out, more militant confrontations with the police attack and the tear gas and rubber bullets and all the rest of it. And interesting things I read, actually a survey that was done by Hong Kong academics, Actually, they surveyed the protesters, both the more moderate ones and the more militant ones, and essentially they both came out that we can see the purpose, we can see the point of both sets of protests. They can actually work together. We don't think one or the other has to be dominant. But what is very important is a regular influx of mass involvement, because without that mass involvement, if it's simply left on the shoulders of a few thousand or a few 10,000 young students and more radical people, then most likely burnout and demoralisation will set in. That is what is so significant about things like the general strike, 5th of August, I'm sorry, I said the 9th of August before, on the 5th of August. Even though it's only partially effective, a long way from shutting down a city-state, it provided an avenue for hundreds of thousands to get involved in a well-publicised and organised event. Also, very significantly, strikes have the capacity to bring the class questions more to the forefront, to begin to mobilise people who may not have come out in the streets already, and also, very importantly, to begin to show a way forward for workers on the mainland as well. And I come to that in just 2 minutes. Okay, so the whole question then of strikes is one of, I say, bringing the class demands more to the forefront, in trying to ensure mass involvement and also helping to push against tendencies towards anti-mainland chauvinism, which takes me to my next point. The struggle for democracy cannot be separated from the fight for liberation on the mainland. Unless the struggle does so, it's unlikely that Hong Kong will be able to end Beijing's tightening grip on the island. This is not ultimately Hong Kong versus China. At its heart, it's about the masses who want democracy and the billionaires who want profits. And those things cannot be reconciled. And therefore raises the issue of how to appeal to mainlanders. There is plenty of issues for those in the mainland to be concerned about and reasons to protest, as in fact there have been. In fact, over the last two or three decades, China has one of the highest rates of civil protest in the world. We don't hear about most of it, but it's happening all the time. Usually isolated, usually only in individual towns or factories, but nonetheless it does happen all the time. And there's a reason for that. It's a protest basically for getting pay, making sure they're recompensed in the event of redundancies, making sure they push back against bullying by management. So, trying to link up the struggle with the fight for liberation of the mainland means taking up two questions. The first I've already mentioned, which is tackling anti-mainlander chauvinism of the movement, which does exist, but how this is guaranteed to alienate the Hong Kong struggle from those in the mainland and to throw mainland workers into the arms of the Communist Party. Another point is the struggle for the movement not to be overly enamoured with this idea of support from the West. Some of those involved in the protests are demanding that West take action in their support. Some figures from the movement have met senior figures in the Trump administration. There have been cases of demonstrators carrying the American flag and singing the American national anthem. In some cases, these demands come from right-wing individuals and groups who just love Donald Trump. But in the majority of cases, this is driven simply out of desperation. They realise that the balance of forces against them, perhaps America and Britain can help tip the scales their way. But there's two obvious problems with this. First, flying the American flag or meeting people like Mike Pompeo only allows the Communist Party to claim that demonstrators are simply in the pay of the United States, that it is all just stage managed by the State Department, is all just a colour revolution to allow America to rule. Second, the idea that Western governments would do anything to save the Hong Kong demonstrations is an illusion. Figures like Republican leader Mitch McConnell may make statements lauding the bravery of the demonstrators, but he has no interest in democracy in the United States, that's for sure. And in Hong Kong, the main interest of people like Mitch McConnell and Mike Pompeo is actually to use Hong Kong only for their own ends. And that end is giving the United States a one-up over China, whether we're talking about trade talks or we're talking about the growing military tensions between the two. So the movement cannot subordinate itself to any idea that the West might come to save them. It's not. Besides which, the American ruling class is not even united about what it thinks about Hong Kong. Trump, of course, has come out and simply described the demonstrations as riots and basically said it's an eternal matter for Beijing to sort out. I want to finalise by talking a little bit about the implications of all this for Australia and why we're here today. Obviously, there's a limit beyond coming to things like the Socialism Conference and listening to talks in Hong Kong about what we can do in Australia to encourage any of these developments. So I want to conclude by making a more general point. The struggle in Hong Kong cannot be isolated from the wider situation in Asia. I mentioned at the beginning of this talk, these have been the biggest protests for democracy in Asia in decades. The last concerted upswing in protest for democracy was in the late 1980s. In 1986, we saw millions coming out in the streets of Manila to kick out long-standing dictator Ferdinand Marcos. In 1987, student-led protests and workers' strikes helped bring down a military dictatorship in South Korea. In 1989, mass protests broke out all over mainland China, including, of course, in Tiananmen Square, demanding democracy for China. Unfortunately, in that case, the regime counterattacked and drowned the revolt in blood. But in all three cases, you can see the same features. What starts out as protests by students and young people in the streets begins to impact on the working class, who begin to move into action, a process that went furthest in South Korea. These movements were fueled by demands for democracy and civil rights, but also against low wages, lack of rights at work, persecution of trade unions, and against the accumulation of fortunes in the hands of well-connected minorities. 30 years later, we face similar circumstances in Hong Kong. Nothing ever repeats exactly the same, but the general features of world capitalism keep throwing up the same types of resistance by students and workers. And the working class in Asia is so much larger today than it was at the time of Tiananmen Square. Globalisation, the outsourcing of so much work in factories and call centres, has meant the whole world economy is so much more dependent on the workers of Asia. Everywhere from Beijing to Jakarta, the workers are tied to each other by the threads woven by the networks, global networks of production. And the capitalists in Asia and beyond are likewise bound to each other by the threads, by the common interests to exploit the workers of the region. Competition between the capitalists and their drive for profits means they have no alternative but to keep exploiting the workers of the region and to keep attacking workers in Asia. Resistance, therefore, is inevitable. So our role here in Australia is to obviously, number one, lend the Hong Kong students our total support as much as we can, to throw ourselves into support for every flick of resistance in Asia, because a win for workers in Asia is a win for workers here too. But ultimately, success or failure in this struggle, victory or defeat, is going to come down to politics. Will the struggles that break out be informed by the kind of politics that will lead to compromise and defeat, or will they be dominated by the politics of class struggle and internationalism that can lead to victories overseas and here in Australia as well? That's how we see our job here at this conference this weekend, to popularise and build the kind of politics and organisation that can regenerate left-wing forces, not just in Australia, but also contribute to rebuilding a radical left in Asia as well. Together, workers in Australia and Asia have a world to win.
That's it from me. Take it away, Tom.
Yeah, sure. Okay, well, I wasn't quite sure how to construct this talk because there were so many different issues I could have raised and discussed, so it's good to hear something that came up from the floor. Okay, in terms of the future in Hong Kong, obviously one possibility is they could win. Carrie Lam could concede, she could be forced out. And I don't think we can rule that out. We say very confidently, you know, there's no way the Chinese Communist Party can afford to concede. But on the other hand, if enough pressure is put on them, it's possible they might. So we can't rule that out. So I think that is not just it all peters out or they're slaughtered. It's possible they could actually push the Communist Party back. The second thing is to say is the analogy of Paris in 1968 comes to mind. Because, you see, the point that Ben Hillier, the guy over there, mentioned before about the fact that mainlanders might be moved not because they think, oh, and I really value democratic rights of the people of Hong Kong, but because they see their own government can be forced back. You see, Paris 1968, general strike of 10 million workers came out. The social distance between the French workers and the French students enrolled in the elite institution of Sorbonne was vast. The people who are against the student protests, including the Communist Party, basically describe them as the boss's sons. They say workers shouldn't really be solidarising with them because they're just, you know, daddy's boys and whatever. And yet, when the students came out and were bashed in the streets of the French Quarter, the Latin Quarter in Paris in May 1968, within days, there was a general strike of 10 million people. Now, as I say, they came out not because they particularly cared about what was in the curriculum at the Sorbonne. They came out because they too have been fucked over by de Gaulle and the French government for decades. They too had seen their wages squeezed. They too had been bashed by the cops. They too had seen their political rights infringed in every way. And so it was a case then that the students actually played the role of what people at the time called a detonator. The struggle by the students actually exploded a lot of the, you know, revealed, exposed, and antagonised the tensions that are actually underway in French society and brought the workers out for their own demands. And so it's possible, obviously the limits of the chap here mentioned about the fact what access, exposure to the news in Hong Kong do mainlanders have, but still, you know, people go back and forth across the border. What is it, like 1,500 a week or something? Vast numbers of people do cross the border and have some idea and go home and tell their friends about what's going on there. And the news kind of creeps out. Actually, they won a victory, let's suppose. You know, the impact that can have on the minds of the mainlanders, given the fact, I mentioned it before, I think it also came up on the floor, it's not like the mainlanders are just anaesthetised, I won't move around anything. You know, there have been repeated demonstrations, repeated strikes. The China Labour Bulletin captures them. But they only captured a small fraction of them, actually. There's strikes and protests and marches happening every week of the year in China. Because, you know, they see, you know, the vast fortunes of the, you know, there was a little meme that went around on Facebook the other day. I shared it about the I call the brats of the CCP. These are the offspring of the CCP figures in the mainland. Send their kids to education places like Australia and Toronto and whatever. And they had, I know what we'll do. We'll expose the Hong Kong students in Toronto, you know, and show how rubbish they are. And we'll all get in our Ferraris and we'll have a mass protest against the Hong Kong students. So they'll all get in their Ferraris and have a convoy of Ferraris through the street of Toronto to expose the Hong Kong students. Well, actually, you know, these people exist on the mainland. Their parents buy them the Ferraris. So the kind of class differentiation that's going on in the mainland is also enormous. And it's not like the people on the mainland, oh, good on them, they got ahead by the strength of their pluck and ingenuity. I say, fuckers, you know, the rich always look after themselves. And they send their kids overseas, you know, to get the best education. They come back and they slot into some elite positions. So all those class antagonisms are alive and well there. And we don't know what's going to set things off. We know the protests in the mainland happen all the time. What we also know is almost invariably they're localised, they're either repressed or bought off. They don't lead to formation of ongoing organisation to help sustain the struggle, to lead debates and so forth. So many times the leaders get jailed or sacked or sent back to their villages. But at some point things are going to break. I mean, surely the Hong Kong situation shows that people can put up with something for so long and then they break. They snap and they begin to move. I tell you what, I was in Hong Kong in 2017 last time, November 2017. I spoke to one of the socialists there named by the name of Ao Lung Yu. I was often interviewed in the Western Socialist Press. In fact, we cover an article, an interview with him. In fact, a speech he gave in Perth last weekend for the Perth version of socialism. And I spoke to Ao. He was so despondent. You know, Hong Kong's terrible. You know, he said, the umbrella movement was great, but then it was crushed and was defeated and was still suffering from the defeat. And the students won't move. All they want to do is get on with their studies and get on with their casual jobs and scrape by the best they can. And the trade unions are so weak and rubbish. And the left is so weak and rubbish. And everyone's bored off by commercialism. It's really all I could do is kind of, you know, stop them crying. But then what happens? 2 years later, you know, wow. You know, Al's been quoted all over the international media for talking about the revolt in Hong Kong. So I think this in some ways, you know, obviously every country is different. The tensions are different. The class antagonisms are different. But what it does say is that revolt can break out anywhere at any time. Because the same kind of, I would just say this one thing. Going back to 2011, there was a, remember Occupy Wall Street, the protests happened in America, the protests that happened in Egypt and something. And people held up placards saying, one world, one pain. They're kind of saying, look, you know, we in Egypt understand what's going on in America. We in America understand the struggle of what's going on in Egypt because we're all fighting neoliberalism and authoritarianism and so forth. And I think that's what's so inspiring about what's going on in Hong Kong, because it shows that people will put up with shit for only so long and they'll fight back. And we can't actually predict, obviously, how things are going to go on. But I think what you pretty much can predict, this is not the last wave of struggle in Hong Kong. We saw 2014, the Umbrella Movement. Things went back and were defeated. And 5 years later, they've broken out much bigger scale. In some ways, more sophisticated, reaching far deeper into the Hong Kong population. And I think, win or lose this time round, this is not the end of the story. The class struggle in East Asia, in China, in Hong Kong, and for that matter, in Japan, South Korea, and all the rest of them, is still a potentially explosive area, a contested point for world capitalism, which has shifted so much resources to this area, so many investments, has so much at stake, that an explosion in this area, political and social explosion, can really set the Asia-Pacific region alight.